maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement, one word, .org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
International Women's Day, so purchase a special KBOO Women's Day 2021 t-shirt to celebrate the day. To purchase, just go to our website at kboo.fm. Wear your support for KBOO and International Women's Day today.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Adam. Stephen.
Now you can say hi to Adam, too. We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in a Zoom is Adam Sanchez and Nina Walbach. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to have you both here. So why don't you start by telling us about your teaching background and experience?
So I actually came to teaching first, I was a violin teacher. So just always played violin and got into teaching that way, and then kind of realized I was more into the teaching aspect than the violin part, and transitioned into my current role as a pre-K teacher and really enjoying it.
I started teaching in Portland, Oregon. I went to Lewis and Clark, and I was a member of PAT for several years there, taught at Jefferson and Madison High School. And then I moved to New York City and taught there for about 5 years. And then about 6 months before the pandemic, I moved to Philadelphia and started teaching in Philadelphia. So I've been here for about a year and a half now.
Great. All right. Thank you. And Nina, you kind of referred to this a little bit, but what inspired both of you to become teachers?
I think it's something I kind of fell into, but now that I'm here, I think the thing that I like most about it is, well, in a pre-pandemic world, you're always on your feet. You're never in front of a computer the whole day. And you get very instant feedback about what you're doing. So you know immediately if your lesson flopped or if it's going well, and there's something really satisfying about that.
I was an activist in Portland, and I worked at Powell's Books. And I was both an anti-war activist and a union activist at Powell's. Was my first experience being in a union, and so I, when I started looking, you know, I didn't imagine myself staying at Powell's over the long term, and I started looking at other career choices. I knew I wanted to go into a union job, and both my parents were history professors, and so I said, I never ever want to go into academia, but you know that old adage, like you become your parents. I guess I thought teaching might be a decent career, and so and I loved history, particularly understanding history and helping people make it relevant for today and understanding the world that we live in.
Great. And what about any sort of official role in your union? I know, Adam, you haven't been there that long, but do either of you have any kind of official role right now?
I am part of our building committee, which is basically the building level representation of the union. So we act sort of as like a liaison between staff and the administration. So actually this is my first year on building committee, so it's been interesting maneuvering that via Zoom, but in a way it's easier because we've been able to meet really regularly and we don't have to work around what part of the building you're coming from, and yeah, so it's been good.
I have no official role
yet, at least. Okay.
So in honor of International Women's Day, we wanted to tie women's rights into this conversation. Women make up more than 3/4 of all kindergarten through 12th grade teachers. So what intersection do you see between feminism and how the teaching profession is viewed? And how would you connect this to the way that teachers are treated in this country?
I think there's a really direct link between the age of the children you teach and how much respect there is for the profession and also how many women you find. So I'm a pre-K teacher, so I can speak to the lower grades. You see, you know, it's fully dominated by women. I think I know 2 male pre-K teachers in the entire city. And you know, unfortunately, like a lot of professions, it's like once you get to the top, you see a lot more men. So in our world, it's like when you have like college professors, then you see, you know, that it's much more of a male-dominated field. But yeah, I see it like even with like the language that gets used. So for example, for my students, I'm Miss Nina, and every pre-K teacher I know is Miss First Name. And that feels like something I'm used to at this point, but it's also a little more like a babysitter. Like we're not grown-ups and you don't call us by our last name. And you know, even like in my own school, even among staff, we're kind of referred to as like baby school. And meanwhile, I spend my days trying to tell my kids that they're not babies. And you know, obviously we know that the early grades are so important for later success. But I do think there needs to be, you know, a bigger effort to like incorporate more men into the early grades so that you see a little bit more evening out with that.
Yeah. I'll say I allow my students to call me Mr. Adam at the high school level, and I'm very looked at as very weird, I think, amongst both my students and teachers for that. But yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's the direct, you know, link. If you look at how, you know, doctors or lawyers or other kind of more male-dominated professions are treated in this country versus the teaching profession, I think there's, you know, obviously that has to do with sexism, and there's the direct link there. But I think also if you look at what's going on during this pandemic, right, the devaluation of raising children in general, you know, that I think is both tied to the way we're looking at schools right now, and the way we're treating parents right now, right? That parents should not be, if they are taking care of their kids during a pandemic, they should not be forced to go to work. The government should have from the beginning been paying parents to stay home with their children and raise them, and not, you know, and if that was happening, we wouldn't have such a huge push to get teachers back into schools as soon as possible. So I think that's also very much linked to the devaluation in this society of child rearing, which, you know, often falls, those burdens often fall on women in this society.
Okay, and that kind of brings us to our next question. We invited you on because of the organizing that's been going on with educators in Philadelphia, especially around reopening school buildings. Can you set the stage for us in terms of what happened leading up to your district's directive for early elementary teachers to return to school buildings and your union's response?
So, Adam, are we on our third attempt now? I think yeah. This is our third official attempt at going back. So we've been virtual since March. We've never actually gone back since then. But, you know, it's like, I think we can all agree, like, no matter what side of this debate you're on, like, this puts you between a rock and a hard place. There's no easy answer to this question. And, you know, the issues in Philly, I think, like a lot of large urban districts, are just different than some of the issues in other districts. So, like, you know, the city, like, during these debates, just like loves bringing up the fact that like Catholic schools are in session and the suburbs are back, and you know, it's really brought to light a lot of just the inequities between, you know, our district and districts like that, including, you know, our buildings and just the like chronic underfunding. So for example, right now, you know, they're looking at like the ventilation issues in our buildings, and it's like, we've known that that's a huge issue this whole time, but only under a pandemic are we like seeing it as directly a problem that needs addressing. And so, yeah, I mean, we've been in this debate for a while, and it just, it's, I think the things that for me make it just even more frustrating is that these issues really are not specific to the pandemic. They've been going on for a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you take a step back, it's easier to understand what's going on in Philadelphia, because, you know, Philadelphia, I look at as one of the cities where schools were really devastated in the both in the Arnie Duncan tenure and before that, No Child Left Behind. You know, you think of cities like New Orleans, like Detroit, where you've had, you know, this, and Chicago to some extent before CORE, that have had this huge privatization push and so forth. You know, Philadelphia was very much a part of that when you had the state takeover of the schools for several years, that charterized schools and so forth, and you know, bled the public schools, and it's always had one of the most unequal distributions. Pennsylvania has had one of the most unequal distributions of state money going to schools of any state. And so, and then on top of that, it's on the East Coast, so you have these incredibly old buildings, right? Some of them are hundreds of years old. And so you have massive issues in terms of ventilation, in terms of, you know, we have a massive asbestos crisis over the last couple of years, lead in the water, you name it, it's in the Philly buildings, poisoning students and teachers. And that has led to a place where there is very little trust in the district leadership to get this reopening right, because they have literally been poisoning students and teachers for decades. And so on, you know, then comes in the district this summer, and they basically made no preparation for virtual instruction and put all their eggs in this, this hybrid basket. And they thought in September they were gonna reopen the schools, and 150 teachers, principals, students, parents showed up, didn't show up, went to the virtual school board meeting, and one after another, it was just literally only people in opposition to this this plan, and they pushed back the first plan. Then they tried again, I can't remember, I think in January, but it was right when, you know, COVID cases were spiking, and so that kind of prevented them from doing it again. And then once again, a couple weeks ago, they started trying to open again, even though, you know, numbers hadn't really gone that much down from the last, I mean, they were still up actually from the last time they tried to open, but because I think they were on a downward trajectory, they thought, oh, well, now's a great time to open, despite it, you know, it being the same time as the new variants were being discovered in the Philadelphia area.
And yeah, I would also just add, like, to your point about, like, why the lower grades, why were we asking them to come back first? Like, I think there's this understanding that, you know, that the youngest kids are suffering the most with virtual learning, and certainly youngest kids are in need of socialization the most, but, you know, the plan that's being proposed does not involve socialization. It involves kids being spaced apart, wearing masks. And honestly, for, you know, as a pre-K teacher, I feel like that might actually do more harm developmentally. So just, you know, I've been really honest with my parents, like, if you're choosing that option for your kids, like, it's not that your kids are going to be playing together. We're going to tell them, like, do not share toys. And so, you know, and just for reference, like, in my own classroom, out of 20 kids, I have maybe two that were interested in hybrid learning in the end, and all of the rest chose virtual. So when you're just looking at these numbers, they're not really matching, you know, what I think the district assumed parents wanted.
Gotcha. So your union leaders, and you haven't mentioned if they needed to be pushed or if they've been on board, but your union leaders asked members not to return to buildings this last time when the district said that you were to return, at least K through second grade. So what happened next? They said, okay, don't return. What kind of actions were taken at that point?
I would say there was definitely a big internal push within the union to kind of get our leadership on board. And, you know, we were, for better or worse, this is a problem that's been happening around the country. So we had other unions to look to for inspiration of how to fight this. And, you know, in Chicago, they did a big push of teachers working from outside the buildings. Creates a lot of buzz. You're showing up, but you're not showing up. And so we, let's see, like 2 weeks ago is when they were going to have teachers show up, but the students would still stay virtual. So this was like the period of time when we're in professional development and setting up our classrooms. So, you know, the nice thing about that was if we plan an action during that time, it's not actually affecting the students. Like, students would not have been in the building anyway. So we worked from outside. And yeah, I have to say it was really cool to just watch the solidarity, like, both within my building and then the surrounding community also. So we had, like, you know, teachers were literally outside in like 30 degree weather on our computers. Many computers died throughout the day. We had local restaurants like delivering heat lamps and, you know, members of the community dropping coffee. And it was just cool to like see that, you know, that kind of solidarity from people around us. And I'm in a pre-K through eight school. And so, you know, even though it was only pre-K to two that were being asked to come back, 3 through 8 was out there with us too. And even high school teachers from nearby high schools came and worked from our parking lot. So there was definitely a lot of, you know, great solidarity for that. That, you know, that did not equal, now we're not going back, but it was, you know, it was cool to see that kind of public push.
Yeah, I mean, just to give a little context about our union, you know, it's very much a service model or business model type union that, you know, it's certainly not an organizing model union. You know, just to give you a concrete example, right, from having been in Portland Association of Teachers, there is no such thing in Philadelphia as a monthly meeting, citywide meeting of building reps. We don't have that. And so there's very little place in the union structures to push the leadership one way or the other. So really all we have is organizing at the building level, which, you know, the leadership ends up hearing about. And so, you know, I think in the lead up to the leadership's decision to tell teachers to refuse to go back, there was organizing being done on the building level from definitely a lot of, certainly a lot of people in the Caucus of Working Educators that both Nina and I are a part of were organizing on the building level to refuse to go back. And so that was happening before, but then obviously when the leadership, you know, leadership said on a Friday, we're not gonna go back on Monday. And so it took a tremendous amount of organizing over the weekend. You know, all of a sudden, this service model union was trying to really quickly transition to an organizing model union. But basically what they did is put it on the building reps, right? So they had, you know, these series of meetings with the building reps and said, like, organize your school to be, you know, be outside. Or at the high school level, it was like, you know, tell your people to go outside and stand in solidarity. And, you know, and I think as a result of that, like, you know, we had a good crowd from my high school that either, you know, that went to various places, but we certainly didn't get anywhere close to the 200 staff that we have out there, right? And I think that would have required, I think, much deeper organizing that we were prepared to do. On the other hand, I will say, you know, our leadership has been, you know, at least rhetorically, has been fairly good compared to, like, the New York leadership, which I think caved very early on reopening. And they have fought and negotiated an MOU with the district, which is not perfect, but it's, you know, it's definitely not, I think, as strong as, like, LA's, but it's, you know, it's in the vicinity of Chicago's, which I think for not being an organizing model union is pretty amazing. And I also think part of that has to do with, we have a fairly friendly, a pretty friendly city council here. We have a number of people who have been elected specifically on kind of as public education activists. And so, you know, I think that gives our union a little bit more room to maneuver than the Chicago union, for example.
Great. And just real quickly, this ended up going to a mediator, right? Supposedly an impartial mediator. What was the decision, and what are your thoughts about having labor disputes go to a mediator?
Logistically, it's been really frustrating because it's meant that the process has just stalled a lot. So, you know, today is Saturday. I really couldn't tell you what's going to happen Monday. Like, Monday was the day we were being told hybrid learning would start. You know, I get the idea of bringing in a third party, for sure. But, you know, it's like an outside opinion could be great. Because obviously this is a really contentious debate. At the same time, it's like, we know our students best. We don't know who this person is. And, you know, as a result, like, administrators, teachers, parents, everyone has just been like in this really anxiety-fueled state of waiting.
Yeah, no, I for sure. It's every couple of days that the date gets pushed back. That's what, you know, it has meant that we have this mediation process. We actually don't have a decision yet, but it looks like they're getting close to one. And so there's supposed to be a big announcement on Monday that is jointly, there's a press conference being jointly held by our union and the district. But what it looks like is going to be the result of the process is that basically what the process did is it forced the district to give more information to the union, because for a while the district was stalling and like wouldn't even let the environmental scientist that the union hires evaluate some of the buildings. And so what it's done is it's forced the district to kind of cough up that information, which is good. But then it's also kind of forced the union to say school by school, does this school meet the provisions in our MOU? And it looks like what's going to happen is if our environmental scientist, our union environmental scientist, says yes, this school meets the provisions, then that school is going to return, while other schools remain closed. And so, in a school system that is already deeply inequitable, that is going to, you know, deepen those inequities for what, right? For maybe 20 in-person days in the rest of the school year. And it's going to upend for those teachers who are forced to go back. It's going to totally upend what they are doing. So, you know, I think it is frustrating that the union put kind of all their eggs in this mediation basket and didn't say from the start, you know, we know teachers need to be vaccinated, that all these schools need to be, you know, properly ventilated, and now is the time to do it. Because if you're not going to do it now, if you're not going to fix the ventilation issues now when lives are on the line, I honestly can't imagine they will ever get fixed.
Yeah. And you kind of talked about this earlier in terms of childcare and people's, you know, sort of being stuck between having to work and rear their children. Now that we've been in the pandemic for a year, are you noticing a shift in public perception and support of teachers by parents and community members? And you talked a little bit about some of the solidarity you saw during the action, the work action outside, but are there efforts to build solidarity with parents and community? And what does that look like, if so?
I mean, I think in a way it's the issue that a lot of, you know, essential workers are facing right now, where it's like, okay, we have this designation essential worker and we appreciate you so much. And, you know, we clap for nurses and we leave notes for our mailman, but like, does that equal better wages? Does that equal better conditions? And so, you know, I think there's some awareness from parents who suddenly have their kids home all day of like, oh, teaching, it's, you know, it's kind of hard. But it's interesting too, like, you know, just in the numbers of who has opted to send their kids back to school, to physical school, you know, it tends to be, at least within our district, the more affluent parents who are choosing that. And I get the sense that it's sort of, you know, parents who are in jobs where they're able to work from home, have their kids at home and are getting annoyed by it and want them back at school. Whereas, you know, for example, my classroom, I teach in a Head Start classroom with exclusively low-income families. And, you know, for better or worse, people have pretty much made a situation work in terms of childcare at this point. And obviously sending your kid back 2 days a week is not gonna actually help you go back to work. So, you know, I would say like there, I've definitely felt the support of my families during this process. I think it's a lot less of the kind of like parents versus teachers that maybe we see in the media. But it's also pretty different, you know, demographically, even within our district.
Mm-hmm. I think teachers have a lot more support nationally than we think in terms of fighting back against some of this stuff. I mean, I think there obviously are tensions because parents want, you know, they are being forced back into work and they need some place for their kids. But I think what we've seen in Philly, especially when, you know, we pointed out things like the district's ventilations plan was putting, you know, $50 Home Depot fans in the residential fans in the windows, you know, parents understand that as completely absurd. And that's something that would never happen in the suburbs, that would never happen in a wealthy community. And so I think when teachers struggle around these issues, people are desperate for someone to fight back right now. You know, the weight of the pandemic is kind of weighing heavily on us. And I think, you know, the national polls bear this out. That there is huge support, at least until teachers are fully vaccinated, to not reopen schools. Although, as Nina pointed out, I think that support erodes the wealthier and the whiter the parents get.
Well, I'm sorry that we have to end this conversation. It was so great to have both of you here. Thank you, Nina and Adam, for joining us on KBOO. And thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at...
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby!